questions?
You mentioned Richard Clark. I wanted to see if you or any of the other members of the survivors have read the book or excerpts from the book and have any reaction to it.
Well, actually, we saw 60 Minutes last night, and we were very, very shocked with what we saw and the amount of information that they had and the accusations that he's giving to the administration. So we're waiting for the book that is actually being released today to see what is in the general idea of what has to do with the commission itself.
Has that shaped your impressions at all, what
yes.
you've seen,
oh,
and
yes.
how so?
Oh, yes. We are more, well, first it was very emotional. We were very emotional because here we have a top-level administration official saying that they knew something, that they took the information, and they went away with that information, and they tried to tag it to the Iraqi people. And all of a sudden, all the focus that they have on Al-Qaeda was shifted to the wrong direction. So we were very, very hurt by that.
One of the things that we feel that should be made public, as much of it as possible, perhaps in redacted form, there was a July 5th meeting that was called for by Richard Clark. At this meeting were members of the Secret Service, all the typical members that would join a high-level national security meeting in the White House. In that meeting, he warned of a spectacular attack that would occur with little or no warning and cause mass casualties. Those are the words extracted from what was leaked from that meeting. So clearly, there's information there that we hope we will hear from what can be released without compromising sources and methods at the upcoming hearings over the next 2 days, because we understand that Richard Clark is one of many top officials, including Tenet, Powell, Madeleine Albright, Sandy Berger, and others who are testifying.
Who are you? What's your background? You're from Rhode Island, I gather. And how did you get involved in this? What were you doing before all this?
Yeah, I've most of my life I've not been what I would call a very political person or very politically involved. Have a strong set of values and concerns, but generally that has never found expression in any kind of political environment. This is not politics. This is about an effort to get to the truth about what happened on 9/11. My personal background is as a professional sailor. I'm a yacht captain. At the time of 9/11, was a fall season, and essentially wasn't sailing at the time. And I read what piqued my personal concern that we weren't getting the whole story about 9/11 were early reports that there was some insider trading, that someone had gotten some foreknowledge and some specifics of the attack enough to place short put options on United and American Airlines. And these were reported across all the mainstream press, and we've yet to see a full report of the investigation that was launched by the SEC after the revelations of the alleged insider trading that one expert named Phil Erlanger estimated were in the billions. So that's what piqued my interest. But prior to my work with Citizens Watch, I was a sailor and did a variety of other things. I ran a disabled sailing program in Newport, Rhode Island.
I'm the co-founder, John Judge, with Kyle, and just brief background on me. I'm from the D.C. area. I grew up in a Pentagon family, civilian employees of the Pentagon, and I'm an independent researcher and investigator, and I was interested in the situation from day one, from 9/11, when the blast shook my windows, when I had seen on local TV for almost a half an hour, they were announcing that a plane was coming toward D.C., and I began independent investigation research at that point. And have continued it, and there's a national and even international network of researchers that contribute to the timeline and that I've been in touch with by email since then, trying to dig out what we can. But we don't have final answers. What we have is many unanswered questions, and we have a commission in process that needs to be addressing these fully and addressing them transparently and releasing the information that's not classified yet.
First was his question in regards to Mr. Clark. We hope at some point he'll be able to meet with the families. We found a lot of his information to be very enlightening, and his statement is more so a reason why President Bush and others should publicly testify so that we can hear what he has to say.
What was it?
Everything was particularly striking to me in that I find him to be a credible witness, his information to be credible, and everything that he spoke touched in a certain way. So it's very important we need to hear from those top officials. And to respond to your request, the 911 Citizens Watch has been very essential to the 911 families, because many of us, a large number of us, are still on the road to recovery. And they've had the awesome ability to do what we cannot find the time to do, because we spend a lot of time in therapy, the doctors, you know, things of that, et cetera. So they help us work and get a lot of the information that we just simply do not have that time to really put into do. So they've been a high asset to the 911 families.
Do any of you have strong opinions about George W. Bush's political ads that refer back to 9/11? And do any of you object to professional actors being used in those ads? And would any of you have suggestions for political ads, future ads being put out during this presidential political campaign?
Yeah, we are. I represent the Hispanic Victims Group and the Victim Support Group. And we can say that the majority of the percentage of the people that we have, around 3,600 people, they all were very, very hurt. They found it obscene that they used those ads for political reason, to use it as a political campaign, when they haven't even given the opportunity to the commission to be interviewed and answer the questions directly of what happened with 9/11. So we are very, very angry that he's using that and marketing his presidency as he did everything on 9/11. No, we don't like it.
And to emphasize what he said, it's not just, you know, that particular organization. It's all organizations. I don't think any 911 family member should be left out as far as any ads relating to 911. And it's very distasteful that not even a heads up, or so much as how would you feel, you know, about that particular ad. Or, but then again, that's how it's pretty much been about a number of things, from the charities to the memorials to ads. There's not much input, or it's been little or no input from the families, and that's where it becomes insulting.
Mr. Rodriguez?
Yes, go ahead.
You said you gave a couple of tapes to the FBI?
No, tips. Tips.
I'm sorry. You gave a couple of tips to the FBI. Can you tell us anything about those?
Sure, sure. I have no problem with that, since they didn't act on it. Number one, I felt that I met with one of the terrorists 2.5 months prior to that, around that time. Not that I met, but I saw him in the building. I don't recall the name of the guy, but he was in the area of the bathrooms, asking how many bathrooms were in the area. And that's information that they should have acted upon.
You said about 2.5 months before.
2.5 months before that, yeah.
So if you're correct, at that time they still didn't know what means they were going to use to attack the building. That would mean they still didn't know at that time they were going to be using planes.
It could be that, or it could be they were looking for another way to bring the building down with extra explosive. Because one of the things that I felt, and that I haven't said it publicly yet, is that when I went up the stairs, I stopped on the 27th floor to left all the firemen that were with me, the whole unit, and I kept going up to the 33rd floor. On the 33rd floor, I had a closet with cleaning supplies. As I was getting masked to give the people that were coming down the stairs, I heard a lot of movement going on the 34th floor, which was a closed floor because of construction. It was burned out, and there was no access to that floor. And I heard heavy equipment being moved on top of that floor. And I was like, oh, my God, somebody's there. And it's not a regular person, because it's heavy equipment. They're moving heavy equipment there. And as I get to the 39th floor, opening the doors for people to get out, Building 2 gets hit. When it gets hit, we heard the rubble coming down, and the 65th floor collapsing, because we heard on the radio we lost 65, meaning that the 65th floor went down in a domino effect, coming down up to the 44th floor, which was the sky lobby. Now, my belief up to this point, they haven't given me any other way to see it, is that maybe in the building there were other kinds of explosives being set up prior to that. And they haven't come forward with that information.
to add to a previous question, how are you calculating your publicity efforts so that you're present while the president is campaigning and demanding specific answers to these specific questions in addition to this event today?
Well, we don't know. We're actually doing the outreach, and the press doesn't have a subpoena power, so you have to get the information of you have to do your own investigation when it comes to everything that is 9/11. And when it comes to the political campaign, we have a lot of people here that are Republican, and they feel very, very offended by what's going on with the investigation. So, you know, I said that because it came out in certain media, with Rush Limbaugh, for example, saying that we were people that were manipulated by the Democratic Party, and it's not like that.
My question is media related. Let me begin with a expression of sympathy for the families that were impacted, and thanks to 911 Citizens Commission for doing this very important forum today. In 1986, when Libya was bombed, and it came out there was a disinformation campaign, Bernard Cow resigned in protest, and when then Secretary of State George Shultz was pushed into a corner and had to respond to the disinformation campaign, his response was to quote Winston Churchill, former Prime Minister of Britain, in times of war, the truth is so precious, it must be attended by a bodyguard of lies. That being the case, from one administration to the next, there appears to have been this penchant for a bodyguard of lies around issues, controversial issues of this nature. We have a lot of cameras here in the press club today. I wonder to what extent the Fourth Estate has been doing its job in asking the tough questions of the government. Holding people accountable in terms of this very important inquiry. What is your read on this?
Well, we certainly encourage. I mean, the answer to that question is sitting out on the other side of the table here. But we certainly encourage the press to listen to the families and listen to the researchers and go after these questions and to help us push the commission. And I think that they've done that to some extent. But not perhaps as much as we'd like at different points. So we're glad to have the audience today and the chance to be on C-SPAN and get these questions out to the public. Someone here had a question.
Yes, you'll be. You'll be hearing from the secretaries of defense and state, both past and former, tomorrow. Yet you feel, and you have a list of questions that you've given out today. Do you believe that they can't answer those questions? After all, many of them, they were often in National Security Council meetings when these issues came up.
Do you think that they can answer them?
I'm asking if you believe they can't answer those questions.
Cannot?
Cannot. I mean, I believe you're also pushing for a testimony from others as well.
Yeah. Well, I think there may be issues that they consider too sensitive to answer, and they would claim national security, although invoking national security in a situation where the rest of us have to live in national insecurity begs the question at times. But I don't think these questions are impossible to answer, but I think the answers to them might begin to get at a deeper history, a historical context to what led up to and has followed 9/11. It might, as the truth often is, not be as comfortable for everyone. But it may enlighten us in ways from which we can determine policy. One of the critiques we have made of the commission is that they are taking panels of testimony about policy on intelligence structure, on security, on all different sorts of homeland security and other issues prior to what appears to be their last topic, which is what happened on 9/11. And to us, that's totally counterintuitive. Unless we can find out what happened really on 9/11, and the theory that we've been given does not hold up in its particulars when looked at critically. The thesis that we've been given down to the starting level of who was actually on the planes and what happened falls apart when you go into the details. We'd like them to be able to answer these questions because some of these questions might begin to get at the truth.
If I could follow up, do you believe these questions are not either going to be asked or answered tomorrow and Wednesday?
Well, we would hope that the commission pays some attention to the families and to us. We have submitted questions in the past, and at least some of the themes have been broached. The families have also been contacted by commission staff with answers to some of the questions they've raised, but the families have not always been satisfied with the answers. We would hope that if this is a commission in a democracy to get at the truth, and they've said they'll leave no stone unturned, they'll go wherever the evidence leads them, then their responsibility to the American public is to ask the hard questions and not to just put people up, ask them soft questions, and have a sort of show up there, but it has no meaning. They should be asking probative questions. At the beginning, we were among the groups that pushed for them to take testimony under oath, and they took the position that perhaps people would be more forthcoming if they weren't under oath, which again we thought was counterintuitive. And so we want them to be as public and as transparent as they can, and also when they're done to release as much of the information on which they're going to base their conclusions as we can. We had this joint inquiry report come out with 28 pages redacted. And it had to do with nations that were involved, possibly, but we're not allowed to know what those nations are. All the way back to the very first evidence that we were supposed to have of what happened. The special report white paper that Colin Powell promised was then withdrawn. So the American people have never really seen much of the evidence in this case. And even the hard forensic evidence that could be released, footage of the Pentagon attack, for instance, there's a lot of non-classified material, and we can't even get them to release that. This is a commission, because it's under the legislature and because of the way the law was written, does not have to have, it doesn't follow the Federal Advisory Group Act, so there's no way to have a formal advisory group to this commission investigation, which is often done in other inquiries. It also, because it came out of the legislature, is exempt from the Freedom of Information Act. So we can't apply to this commission to get any of the documents that they're looking at or the materials. And all of this goes the other way from what ought to be a sunshine process. And this was a critique of the commission on the shuttle as well, because people said, why don't you put out the evidence you're finding on the shuttle and let the whole nation and all the expertise, scientific and engineering expertise in this country, take a look at it and tell you what they can. And when you do open that door up, I think people will come forward. I'm sure you heard stories today that you didn't know about, and there are many more among the families and among the public.
Excuse me, sir. You allege on many of your website and some of the others that you're linked to, and in this book that you distributed today, it's also alleged, New Pearl Harbor, that American Airlines 77 did not crash into the Pentagon, and the Pentagon was not struck by a Boeing 757, but by a missile. On what are you basing that, and what do you think happened to American Airlines Flight 77 and all the people on it?
Well, I don't know if you looked at our website closely. I mean, some of the websites do raise this question. The best evidence that we've seen and work that I've done with eyewitnesses is definitely that Flight 77 went into the Pentagon. And there were people that I know that were familiar with the plane that went to the crash site and saw the pieces of it. There are other sites, and it is mentioned in the book. I think it's mentioned in the context that he's not sure of this. But that evidence is around. There was a best-selling book in France that tried to put it forward. But we have not taken a position in support of it. We do know that some of the critics are raising it. But I think our job is not to prove the obvious, but rather to get on to what's not visible. So we have not taken a position. I don't know what you saw on the website that made you feel so, that Flight 77 didn't go into the Pentagon. But we have just left open. I mean, Kyle, before he started this, was with unanswered questions, and we've left open to people to raise questions that they have, and those should be answered by a probative process.
Now, the book that you're recommending that you distributed today says the photographic evidence in sum provides several reasons to conclude, not question, but conclude, that the Pentagon was not hit by a Boeing passenger plane, but was instead hit by a military missile. When you make charges like that, don't you think you kind of discredit your approach to this entire matter?
First off, sir, we're not making that charge. John has quite eloquently suggested that we take an issue with that case. The bulk of that book makes a very strong case of many of the other areas that we've addressed in this conference. And we believe that the best way to put that particular question to rest is for the Pentagon, for the commission, to release video or photographic evidence of the hit. Let's put it to rest. Let's put these distracting questions. if there was a plane, let's see the video evidence of it. There is also a piece of evidence sitting in the Smithsonian, something that fell off the plane into the back seat of a woman's car. She got home in a state of shock. She found this piece. She made a little box with an American flag inside of it, and she gave it to the Smithsonian. It very easily could put that particular question to rest if that piece of that plane, which I believe came off the plane when it hit a lamppost on its way into the Pentagon, was analyzed for its resins and the fibers in that particular piece. It was not a piece of aluminum. It was some kind of carbon fiber or composite. That could put the issue to rest. I think only through forensic evidence and a full analysis of the evidence can we resolve that question. But clearly, those kind of questions, I believe, are somewhat distracting when there are many other questions that the family members and others have raised that have yet to be addressed. And the record of stonewalling, of appearance of conflicts of interest and so on that have plagued the commission from its start.
I want to ask, do you feel that the severe limitations placed on the presidential briefs regarding their access, only allowing Mr. Zelikow, who is, as you all have said, severely conflicted, working for the Bush transition team and other areas and so forth. What is the problem with not allowing the whole commission to see all of the briefings? Because I believe it was Gorelick and Zelikow were given access, and then they got to choose which briefs out of the 3,000 or 4,000 were the ones that were most important, and then the chairman and the vice chairman got to see the briefs which they chose. Now, Zelikow is not even appointed by Congress or the president. He's selected, by members of the commission. So what we're saying here is that those two individuals, the chairman and vice chairman, got to see the briefs, and then the notes were taken, a 17-page report. It's kept at the White House, edited by White House lawyers. So there's severe restrictions. Do you think that what they're trying to do is to keep the presidential knowledge, prior knowledge, before the attacks, away from the American people, so that they will not scrutinize his actions, his strange actions? And, for example, why General Meyer stayed at his desk while all four planes crashed, while Secretary Rumsfeld stayed at his desk and never entered the war room until the third plane crashed and hit his building, and why the president sat at the elementary school even after the reporters rushed out to cover the story.
Well, to answer the first part of your question, Tom, every member of the commission has top-level security clearance. So we believe that the entire commission should see the presidential daily brief of August 6th, indeed any presidential daily briefs which pertain to 9/11, which pertain to the warnings that came in, the documented the warnings that came in from foreign intelligence services. We don't feel it's appropriate for Philip Zelikow, with such close ties to the Bush administration, who sat for many months on his Foreign Intelligence Advisory Board, to be reviewing the presidential daily briefing. And those notes are then edited and so on. So, in fact, Bob Kerry, who joined the commission after Max Cleland left, said that he was so unhappy and dissatisfied with the current state of affairs relative to access to the presidential daily brief that he was considering resigning. And he had just joined the commission. And I believe Representative Romer has also said, voiced some frustration about the lack of access. As to the second question about foreknowledge, or exactly, obviously we don't know what was in there. We do know that that briefing was titled, and most people in this country don't know, but it was leaked that the title of that August 6th briefing was Bin Laden Determined to Strike in U.S. At one point they tried to drop the "in," suggesting that this was an overseas threat. This is another one of the misleading statements that have come from the Bush administration since 9/11, that it was an overseas threat, that the buzz, the noise in the system was an overseas threat. No, it was a threat to domestic targets in the U.S. And in foreign intelligence agencies, President Putin was interviewed on MSNBC and said that there were, Arabs training to be pilots to use planes as weapons and target, buildings in the U.S., high-value targets in the U.S. So we don't know, but we know that that there was a very clear warning of an imminent attack, and this particular brief mentions hijackings. What else it mentions, we simply don't know.
As a follow-up, if these briefings are known to the public, and they say that there were Arabs training as terrorists, training to take flight lessons, and everybody and the government knew about it, and there were the issue of the individuals that were in the country and so forth, if they were all there, then how is that going to affect what the president, when people go to look at why was he sitting there, why did he continue, why did the top general in United States military soil stay in his office and talk to Max Cleland while four planes crashed when he knew about the first one in the first place? And we haven't even touched about the issue of when they first knew, because it's obvious that the plane was hijacked at 10 minutes after 8 o'clock in the morning, 20 after it turned south 110 degrees. So they knew it was hijacked. That's 2 hours before the last plane crashed. Now you're telling me Operation Vigilant Guardian, with planes heading up and down all up and down the coast, no one was able to do that, to intercept that plane in 2 hours. Impossible. So what I'm saying here is that, do you think that the president would be able to justify his actions if the public knows what he knew before the attacks, before 9/11 and during the attacks?
Well, I think we can't know what justification the president would have. We just have these standing questions that belie a normal national command response level. And we have Rumsfeld saying he was sitting in his office doing papers until the plane hit. I mean, that's the Secretary of Defense. We have Myers, acting Joint Chief of Staff head, knowing about the first plane hitting but going into a private meeting and no one interrupting him, apparently, and coming out, according to his statements, at the end of it. President Bush reportedly being told by Andrew Card, the staff member in Florida, about the second plane hitting, and then apparently not responding, although we don't know specifically what Card told him. And yes, this is after a long period. By 8:24, we now know, all of the federal agencies had a phone bridge open. The FAA...
There's some discrepancy about that. The FAA released a statement at the second hearing which established the phone bridge at 8:46.
Okay. Well, then there's a conflicting statement, but there were reports from the FAA towers and indications of air emergencies as early as 8:18. And there was interagency communication. When the FAA first testified, they didn't have any timeline at all to present to the commission. And then they came forward with one that said that they finally declared Flight 77 a hijacking as late as 9:24. That's well into the scenario. They knew the plane had turned around well before that. And whether or not it was a hijacking is not the issue, because the FAA NORAD response goes to any air emergency, any situation where a transponder is turned off, communication with tower fails, plane takes a deviant course for any period of time, stops taking commands from towers. You have live people there. You have live people down where it's going to hit. It becomes an air emergency, and NORAD responded. They responded 67 times in the year previous to that to normal air emergencies in a timely way. And yet that day, apparently, the entire structure broke down, even though they were involved in Vigilant Guardian and on-top readiness at many bases. The command structure failed to carry this. The only statement we've gotten from the National Military Command Center that I've seen was on 60 Minutes at the first anniversary, where General Montague said, "We didn't respond right away because the FAA was tracking four seemingly unrelated hijackings." Now, that's a very curious quote to me. I don't understand why hijackings have to be related before you respond, or how you would determine it. Although if you have four on the same day and you haven't had any for about 10 years, you might consider them highly related. But even if they aren't, what's the difference? Don't you respond to the first one? You wait for a second one? It's a nonsensical statement to me. And I think these are the kinds of things that I think we want the commission to draw out the answers, not only from the Pentagon brass and the NORAD brass, but down to the pilot level. Talk to the pilots at Otis. Talk to the pilots at Langley, who they finally scrambled too late to get to the scenarios. The pilots at Langley weren't even scrambled to defend D.C. They were sent to New York, according to what they say in the book Among the Heroes. What was the defense, and why was it so delayed? And and then on the national command level, why weren't people who apparently had been given briefings and could have known that there was a problem, in flux? I mean, why weren't they ready to move on that day?
And it's back where they were. How come all of the Al Qaeda
all the Al-Qaeda people were let to leave the country that evening? How did they get clearance to fly when all of the airplanes were supposedly grounded?
There was apparently a flight, I don't know if it was that evening, but it was within the next few days, that before commercial traffic had been restored, that included a number of members of the bin Laden family, and they were...
And over 100 Saudis. There were several flights that made their way around the U.S. picking up members of the bin Laden family and Saudis. They were then flown to Boston. This has been well documented now. Flown to Boston, and I think on the eve of the clearance for commercial flight to resume, they left the country. But it was during the grounding that I should add, without extensive briefings. So you know we've been keeping people for 2 years and interrogating them, but the bin Laden family members and a group of Saudis, over 100, were allowed to leave the country would have to have been only cursory interrogations by the authorities.
In your ad, you say that you'd like President Clinton and Vice President Gore to testify. How much responsibility do you all place on them for not preventing 9/11?
Well, again, I mean, we are... I mean, we're limited in our ability to draw conclusions up at that level. But I think that they were on watch during a period of the historical development of these situations. Now, many of the Clinton officials seem to be saying, Clark recently, Madeleine Albright, when her book came out, that they were in fact tracking bin Laden and Al-Qaeda closely, which would seem to make sense. There are a number of people in the FBI that complained after the transition into the Bush regime that ongoing investigations that they had of suspects were called off or interfered with or obstructed. And there's many number of books about that. There's a complaint, it seems, that they were in fact maybe not responding in a military open way in the way that the Bush administration has responded, rightly or wrongly, and that can certainly be contested. But I mean, they seem to have been at least very aware and given these briefings and tried to convince the incoming transition team and the Bush administration of its importance. I think Clark transitioned into the new administration, so I don't know how you gauge, you know, their level of responsibility. And of course, when it's a political season, everybody wants to place the blame one place or the other. It's probably much more complex than that, than just saying the guy in charge has to take all the heat, because things happen in this country. I mean, part of the problem is the reason that speculations come up, like this gentleman mentioned about Flight 77, we're in a situation where, because of a national security state, much of the information we need is placed into a classification system instead, and it's not accessible to the public, or even if it is accessible somewhat, the media don't get a lot of it out to the public in many cases. So we're kind of in a situation where we're allowed to believe anything we want, but to know nothing, and that makes it impossible to act. And the way to be responsible, it seems to me, is to reverse that so that we do know and we get the historical record. So I can't say, but Madeleine Albright said what one question that raised for her was how they could know so much about these attackers right after the incident and so little about them previous to it. But somebody wasn't on watch.
As a partial follow-up, do you have a good estimate of the number of FBI agents or the amount of FBI hours that went into investigating Clinton himself during his last years in office, as opposed to this kind of thing?
I don't have an estimate of it. I do know the cost of, like, the Whitewater investigation alone was much greater than the amount of resources that have been given to this commission, as was the shuttle investigation. This commission has a limited life and a very small budget comparatively for one of what ought to be one of the most important events to be studied in our current history. I think they had to extend it to $14 million. It originally started out at about $9 million, wasn't it?
No, it was initially funded at $3
million. Oh, the $3 million, yes.
And it went to $14 million, and with the two-month extension, they just got another $1 million. Contrast that to a multi-year investigation into Whitewater, which cost $40 to $50 million, and a space shuttle, the shuttle accident investigation, which was launched immediately, and I believe was funded to... the level of $50 million. So,
yeah. As my good friend John here is aware, I serve as Director of Operations for the Peace and Justice Foundation, but I am also a Muslim American, and so I'm the probably the lone voice of Islam here in this conference today. It has been our position from the very outset, and we wrote our own report, and it's accessible on our website, peacethroughjustice.org, that the attacks of September 11th, to the extent that there were Muslims involved, it was a clear violation of the fundamental tenets of Islam. Clear violation. But it has been our position from the very beginning that the Muslims who were involved were nothing more than bit players in a much larger, well-orchestrated conspiracy. Now, one of the major networks did I think it was either a two or three-part story on major corporate multinational investigations that were impacted by that tragedy. To what extent do you know, do you have information about this? And the second related question is, outside of the Arab world, do you know of any other governments that may have in any way some nebulous ties to this unfortunate conspiracy?
Catherine Austin Fitz spoke here earlier, and I understand that she's just completed a piece called 9/11 Profiteering, where I have not read it. I don't know the conclusions it draws or the questions it raises, but I believe it's posted on Scoop Media at scoop.co.nz, and it will also be published at globalresearch.ca. Well, Catherine was once invited to join the board of directors or the board of governors of the Federal Reserve. She understands how money works in this world quite well, maybe better than most, I would say. And so I'm very interested to hear what she has to say about that. As to the general issue of war profiteering, some of you might be aware that Kevin Phillips' book, American Dynasty, is, I think, number two or three on the New York Times bestseller list. And he documents four generations in the Bush family, going back four generations to World War I, of a clear record of war profiteering. The involvement of the Bush family, and that he examines the Bush family as a dynasty, because we've never had two members of the same family separated by only one president. So I would encourage those who are interested in examining that question a little more deeply to pick up Kevin Phillips' book, American Dynasty, Fortune, Aristocracy, and the Politics of Deceit in the House of Bush.
And about the Muslim situation, yes, you guys have been very affected. It's bad publicity, bad public relations. Right now, I've been in contact with the families of Spain, and they're very hurt now that the connection again is with the Muslims, and I'm going to be taking a group of five family members and maybe two Muslim clerics over there next week.
And as to your part about the countries, all we know is that there were multiple countries in the redacted pages of the Joint Inquiry Report that were referred to. There was a sort of a winking hint that Saudi Arabia was one of the countries. Another one that we have been looking at is Pakistan, especially Pakistani intelligence. I think it was brought up today about this transfer by the head of Pakistani intelligence, whose head rolled when he got back for being too close to bin Laden, of $100,000 to Mohammed Atta in August. And he was here in September, in the early weeks of September, meeting with Richard Armitage and Colin Powell and George Tenet at the CIA. And even that morning he had breakfast with Porter Goss and Bob Graham, who wrote sat over the Joint Inquiry Report, Mahmoud Ahmed. And we've been trying to track whether or not there was Pakistan. Now, I asked Graham specifically whether that was one of the countries they looked at, and he denied. But I don't know whether they have a different standard for, sort of, pointing at Saudi and not at somebody else. But outside of the Arab world, I don't know. I mean, whether there was involvement of other countries or even involvement within this country at some level that we don't yet understand.
But on the corporation level, we remember that on June last year, there was an investigation, and I believe the investigation is still going in New York, that two corporations, General Electric and Halliburton, have $1 billion of the retirement fund of the firefighters and the police invested in countries that promoted terrorism.
I just want to say that this new book that's just come out examines this question of conspiracy and the question of whether or not there were elements somewhere within the U.S. government that were somehow complicit in 9/11. It's a very disturbing thing to consider, but nevertheless looks at the evidence, looks at the timeline, looks at Nafis Ahmed's The War on Freedom, looks at the public record, and raises questions and examines a range of theories. It needs to be looked at. We haven't drawn any conclusions ourselves. We're just bringing forward this information to the general public.
I'd like to share a little bit of information that may be helpful. First of all, the FAA knew that cockpits were a problem back into the early 90s and didn't fix them. In 1995, following Bojinka, the FAA knew that they had Arabs over here training as pilots. I know because I worked with the FAA and I found the guy and the school that he attended. I knew how he dressed and the book bags he carried. A few days ago, a very significant anniversary passed, 18 March. A year ago, Elaine Kaplan, the chief counsel of the Office of Special Counsel, sent to the White House the report on Bogdan Dokovic, who is an FAA-validated whistleblower. The report, it contained Bogdan's original complaint. It contained a lying Kenneth Meade, who is the Department of Transportation Inspector General and former GAO official. The report, Bogdan shredded that with over 500 pages of documentation. He then rebuffed a James Loy lying document, and this was all sent to the White House a year ago. If you want to see Ken Meade's report, go under the Office of Special Counsel's website for 2003. I think it's PR8. It's around that. You'll see it's FAA official. Talks about the FAA red team and malfeasance leading to a danger to the public. At the bottom of that, you will see Ken Meade's report. That's a PDF document. Open it and read it. Ken Meade, chapter and verse, admits that they knew all these vulnerabilities in the FAA, access control, badging, cockpits, so forth, and that they did nothing. His excuse was that the FAA red team's examples or the information, and I was on the red team, could not be used because it was too much, and this is a quote, like a terrorist would do. Begs the question, what exactly was the purpose of the DOTIG? The DOT knew this. Jane Garvey knew it. Capitol Flynn knew it. They did absolutely nothing. They've all been rewarded, promoted, and they're still out there. If you attended the last hearing of 9/11, Capitol Flynn and Jane Garvey and Claude Monod, who is the intelligence chief for the FAA, had 12 people on his watch list, and the State Department had 60,000. I believe it was Secretary Lehman asked him, are you stupid? And the room broke into applause. Claude Monod got promoted to the head of intelligence for the TSA, got a $16,000 bonus, and after that hearing just returned to the FAA. So there's a lot they knew. Look on that website. Thank you.
Yeah. I think we've got a couple of examples of what appears to be a rewarding failure in this situation where people that should have taken responsibility or taken action. And it's incomprehensible to me that this long after the Pentagon itself was hit, that there's not been a single court of inquiry or a military court-martial or a full investigation internally that we know anything about. I don't even remember a few years ago there was a submarine, U.S. Navy submarine, that surfaced and it hit a trawler in Japan and sank it and some people died. The captain of that submarine is no longer on that boat. I don't think he's even in the Navy still. I'm sure that he got in trouble for it. I'm sure there was a hearing. I'm sure there was a demotion. And that was a small matter, I mean, with a few lives. And yet nothing like that has happened. It happened after Pearl Harbor. There were hearings and court martials, but nothing after 9-1-1 when the headquarters of the Defense Department is struck by a plane. We still have yet to determine what happened when the head of security could tell me in 1999 that they were on Delta alert, their highest form of alert, because of phone calls threatening bombs in the Pentagon, and had radar and cameras on the roof to watch out for planes. What happened between 1999 and September 11, 2003, that no system of defense that worked was put into place? And what happened to the people that were responsible for doing that? If we're just going to promote them and brush it under the rug and say it's all external, then I think we're not going to learn any lessons that can get us any further out of the mess that we're in, globally and nationally as well.
Thank you all very much for
coming. Thanks so much for coming.